This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. A 6-year-old water quality sample in Bloomington shows the presence of toxic chemicals formerly used in Teflon, though below levels the EPA considers a danger. Bill Walker of the Environmental Working Group disagrees with the legal standard.
Certainly it's a level that if it were in my water, I wouldn't be drinking it without a filter.
Find out more about PFAS in Eric Stock's report. Plus, Sheriff John Sandage gives an update on the now operational addition to the McLean County Jail. GLT's Grow tells you whether covering up exposed tree roots is really the thing to do. John Norton previews GLT summer concert headliner Adia Victoria. And correspondent Laura Kennedy looks at the phenomena of erasing things from our culture. War statues, singers, certain movies, you name it. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. An environmental advocacy group lists Bloomington among more than 600 locations across the country whose water may be contaminated with a highly toxic compound. As GLT's Eric Stock reports, Bloomington officials maintain the city's water is safe. Environmentalists say no one can be certain until more testing is done.
The Environmental Working Group recently released a report which indicated Bloomington tested positive for trace levels of PFAS. That's short for perfluoroalkyl and polyfluoroalkyl substances. They're a class of water-soluble man-made chemicals used in waterproof clothing, fire-retardant foam, and formerly Teflon. The group claims as of March, the compound has been detected in 43 states, potentially contaminating the drinking water systems of more than 19 million people. A test in 2013 detected PFAS at 47 parts per trillion in Bloomington's groundwater, which falls below the Environmental Protection Agency's advisory threshold of 70 parts per trillion, which would trigger mitigation. Still, Bill Walker, editor-in-chief of EWG.org, says that's cause for concern.
You know, it's not as great a concern as what we've seen in some other contaminated systems, but certainly it's a level that if it were in my water, I wouldn't be drinking it without a filter.
Bloomington Public Works Director Jim Cart says the city isn't sure how the initial study showed trace levels of PFAS, but three subsequent tests later that year showed no indication of the compound, so the city no longer had to test for it.
We weren't a community that needed to continue to look at it. There were no concerns, and so we still do meet all of our state and federal requirements for safe drinking water.
PFAS are generally more prevalent near military bases, airports, firefighter training sites, and industrial plants and industrial landfills. The Federal Safe Drinking Water Act doesn't include enforceable limits for PFAS. The Trump administration decided earlier this year it would not require additional testing. The Environmental Working Group believes there's enough uncertainty about PFAS they should be tested more frequently than the federal government currently requires. Walker acknowledges the science around the safety of PFAS is still evolving, but he points to studies which show pregnant women who drink the contaminated water have a higher risk of having children with developmental disabilities, greater risk of obesity and weakened immune systems. In some cases, defects were reported in fetuses and those with weakened immune systems with just one part per trillion PFAS contamination in their water. Walker says studies have shown higher rates of cancer and kidney disease for those who have had daily exposure to the chemicals over a number of years.
Every state in the country ought to be undergoing some level of testing at least. And states that have not done very much testing, I would say that they are not doing their duty to protect their citizens.
Joan Brame is a sociologist at Illinois State University, and she studies water quality issues. She says the Federal Agency for Toxic Substances Disease Registry has proposed capping allowable PFAS levels at 7 to 11 parts per trillion, but the EPA hasn't taken action on the proposal, a threshold more restrictive than what the EPA is currently suggesting. She says that points to the wide range of opinions among experts over what the standard should be.
Because we just just don't know enough about these chemicals. You know, we have a long history in this country of certainly using chemicals and then realizing that they are not good for us. We have examples of DDT, you know, other chemicals that we have historically used, where then we find out that they are, in fact, carcinogens.
Brame suggests the U.S. has it backwards when it comes to allowing chemicals to be used until they are proven unsafe. She notes in Europe, chemical regulation requires extensive testing for human and environmental health effects before a chemical can be placed on the market.
Basically, no data, no market. And here, we basically have to prove that a chemical is harmful before its use can be stopped.
Brame says more cities and towns should take it upon themselves to test for these chemicals with or without federal mandates, though she adds Bloomington and Normal have long histories of protecting the safety of their drinking water supplies. Karch with Bloomington Public Works says he would support more extensive testing.
We do believe it is something that should be monitored regularly. It is that is a good thing to look at.
But Karch says he doesn't see the need for Bloomington to take on additional testing on its own because he says the city isn't at risk. ISU's Joan Brame says many mistakenly believe they can simply remove all chemicals with a water filter, but she says most commercial filters won't remove PFAS. Cart says most water quality problems are caused in the home.
It is good in your home to make sure that you're really changing and cleaning out those aeration devices on the end of your faucet. When's the last time that you might have checked that? If it's been a year or never, now would be the time.
And a report from the Environmental Working Group also showed PFAS contamination in Galesburg and Rantoul, the site of a decommissioned Air Force base. I'm Eric Stock.
Illinois State University's Joan Brame says bottled water generally isn't any safer than what you draw from the tap because it faces fewer regulatory steps than municipal water supplies.
Support for GLT comes from Zimmerman and Armstrong Investment Advisors, offering securities through First Allied Securities, member FINRA SIPC. Over 30 years of experience, reputable financial management with an independent perspective. Drake Zimmerman has been a proud sponsor of GLT since 1983. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, whether to cover tree roots or not, it's GLT's Grow. The new McLean County Jail addition became fully operational this month. The nearly $40 million facility almost doubles jail capacity. More than 70 beds in one of the pods are designed for what Sheriff John Sandage says is to prepare for future needs. Sandage tells GLT's Eric Stock crews are now upgrading the old space to provide better care for those in the detention facility.
That is the new jail medical unit for the most part, which gives us a lot more room up there for the medical staff when dealing with inmates.
Any new project has its surprises or glitches all along the way. Anything in this project that has come as a surprise?
Not really a surprise. Of course, there's little things that have to be tweaked along the way and things that you notice after contractors leave that, you know, you want fixed. But for the most part, it's been a smooth project.
So you've been able to occupy the new space, the mental health wing, the female pod with kitchen and laundry function in the new space, general population, male inmates, and also the video visitation. How do you feel about it, having gotten to this point and seeing those dimensions now in play?
We're very thrilled with it. And now, of course, we've still got training to do, get our staff acclimated to it. There's a lot of new technology that we're using that the staff has to be brought up to speed on. So that's a big part of our concern right now is making sure we get them up to speed and feeling comfortable in their environment.
Can you give me some examples of some of the things that they need to learn that's sort of new for them?
Just the philosophy itself of direct supervision. We've trained our whole staff on it. It's different. Type of supervision than what a lot of them have done before in the old linear part of the jail.
What are some of the challenges that they face? What are the most important things for them to understand as they go about the more direct supervision of the inmates?
Well, one of the big things is we try to stress to them that when they're the pod officer, that they're kind of like the mayor of a little village. And of course, being able to communicate well with the inmates and at the same time let them know that they are in charge, but that the inmates also are responsible for how well the pod works and what privileges they get.
And along with the new jail, the county is starting several new programs to help address mental health needs, and the jail expansion was a big part of that. But also the FUSE program will be starting soon, Frequent Users System Engagement. It aims to get help to those with serious and chronic mental health needs, those who are frequently in the criminal justice system, for example. What role will the Sheriff's Office play in helping to identify those who may be brought into the FUSE program?
Well, we big part of that will be our officers on the street. As far as, is this something that the FUSE program can assist this person with and kind of divert them from the jail, which, you know, we try to do in the case of mental health inmates.
The desire to better address mental health needs in the county is certainly a long game. There's a lot of upfront investment with the goal of better serving the population long term and eventually get that cost back by having fewer incarcerations, as you said. How do you measure the impact that this is having versus the cost that your office and the county as a whole are putting into this effort?
Well, I think you would measure the impact by, are you, once you help these people, are you seeing them again? You know, that's a big part of the frequent utilization. You know, we see some of the same people cycle through the jail again and again, and if we can get them the help that they need so they don't cycle back through our jail, I think that's how you measure your success.
How is the environment different for female inmates as opposed to how it had been prior?
Prior, we had them in a dormitory type setting and not enough bed space for all of them, so some of them were sleeping on mattresses on the floor. This is a by far a more up-to-date facility. Everybody has a bed, and it's more comfortable surroundings.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Eric Stock with the McLean County Sheriff John Sandage. I want to shift gears to the Illinois Sheriff's Association. You and the association came out recently saying that there are public safety concerns that were being ignored with proposals to legalize marijuana for recreational use. So do you feel we will be less safe with marijuana being legal on a broader scale?
I do, and there's numbers out there that support that. About a month ago, I was in Quantico, Virginia with sheriffs and police chiefs from all over the United States, and I had an opportunity to speak with some that from Colorado and listen to the issues they've had with legalized marijuana, and it honestly, it scared me. They have seen no real benefits of it, and there's actually a report that you can Google. It's Rocky Mountain HIDTA. It's the High Intensity Drug Trafficking Association from Colorado, and these are facts from crime reports that are on there that will show exactly how crime has increased, how accidents have increased, and how hospital admissions have increased.
Will you need additional officers to help manage this?
I don't think we'll need additional officers, but it, you know, it's a lot of people bring up the fact, well, alcohol is legal and alcohol has problems, and yeah, absolutely, I agree. So why are we going to legalize something that's going to add more to that? My main concern as sheriff is public safety, and if there's more intoxicated or impaired drivers on the road, that's a concern to me.
Now, based on data that was presented at GLT's community conversation last week, they said marijuana use went up only slightly among young adults, the age group that police might be more concerned about, I would imagine. It actually went down. They say it was largely a wash, and it was likely to be used more safely and responsibly with it being legal. Do you think that's an incorrect characterization?
Well, I think you can find studies out there to support whatever your point of view is. But when you look at crime reports, those are fact-based.
If you can tie them to marijuana use in each case. Now, proponents argue there will always be lawbreakers no matter what's legal. The police and the court system won't have to spend nearly as much time and resources dealing with low-level marijuana cases. And the sheriff's group has said that legalizing marijuana greatly increases its use.
And here's the thing. I'm not naive enough to think that this isn't going to happen. Our concern is to make sure that there are regulations and safety precautions in place to make sure that when it does happen, it's done safely. And we don't want to see situations where marijuana ends up in the wrong hands or that the public is at risk.
And are there particular safeguards that you or the association would get behind to mitigate what you fear are the concerns that would come about?
One of our main concerns is the homegrown portion of it, where they're asking that each person's allowed to grow 5 plants. There's really no way to regulate this, and it's got the potential to lead to people selling it because they're not growing it for their personal use. They're growing it to make money. So home grow is a big concern of ours.
That's McLean County Sheriff John Sandage with GLT's Eric Stock. Sandage also says mass expungement of marijuana convictions would burden the legal system and law enforcement. He says that would open the door to anyone with felony convictions to obtain firearms.
South Carolina blues rock via Nashville, a New Orleans brass band, and a legendary Bloomington outfit play the 2019 GLT Summer Concert presented by CEFQ. Atlantic Records recording artist Adia Victoria headlines the show on Saturday, June 8th. You'll also see the Grammy Award-winning Rebirth Brass Band, the Something Brothers, and the emerging Third Street Down. The GLT Summer Concert, June 8th in downtown Bloomington, is free. Details at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from the Illinois Prairie Community Foundation, a grant-making organization committed to helping you meet your philanthropic goals through donor advice funds, endowments, scholarships, and more. More information at ilprairiecf.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, Laura Kennedy, our arts correspondent, talks with GLT's culture maven about cultural erasure, canceling things like war memorials and movies and songs. The first instinct with exposed tree roots is to cover them up. But is that the right instinct? Or could doing nothing be the best option? In this episode of GLT's gardening podcast, Grow, ISU's Patrick Murphy and GLT's Mike McCurdy answer a listener question about exposed roots.
Tree roots can help anchor and feed the tree, but what happens when the roots are exposed? Can it hurt the tree to leave it, or could you do more damage by covering the roots up again? I'm Mike McCurdy. This is GLT's Grow, your source for practical gardening advice from our expert Patrick Murphy from Illinois State University School of Biological Sciences and curator of the Fell Arboretum. And Patrick, we received a question from Jody in Normal, who had a question about those exposed roots. What did she ask?
Jody is interested in addressing a scenario that she has with a three stories tall, maple tree. It looks to be a sugar maple or a silver maple from the photo she kindly provided. And this tree has a large flare of roots, and it looks like it's pretty close to a building because you can see the building in the photo. And she wants to address the soil that's left between these roots and also to mitigate the splishy splash of soil that keeps showing up on the house.
It looks like the soil has simply eroded and the roots are exposed. Is that what's happened?
I think what we're seeing is a common occurrence that is indicative of the genus and species of certain trees. You know, so bald cypress is a tree that oftentimes has a knee root that comes up, but that's when there's lots of surface water. Maple trees, particularly silver maple, which are very fast-growing trees, those roots swell up and they grow as quickly as the above-ground parts. Same is true for the sugar maple. And as they grow, they emerge from the earth. And it's a flare, and it's part of the tree's strength.
So there's a photo. You can see this photo at WGLT.org. What does it show?
The photo shows the base of the tree where the trunk flares into the ground. That's known as the buttress flare, where these large muscular roots radiate out from the tree. And the roots that are, let's say, closest to the trunk, maybe halfway into the drip line, they're a muscular root that's kind of like a large branch or a limb that's part of holding the tree to the ground. And as those roots radiate out and they grow past the drip line, the root structures that are on the ends of those bigger roots are the ones that are taking in water with nutrients.
So I'm guessing the answer to her question is nuanced. Let's get into it. Can she dump soil on top of these exposed roots?
You got to use a lot of caution and good judgment there, because changing the grade around the buttress flare, it can suffocate the tree essentially and stop the tree's growth, and that equals death.
And the buttress flare is, again, that's where the trunk sort of goes into the ground and flares out.
Yes, Mike, and I've heard people refer to it as an elephant's foot, you know, because it kind of has that look. And the little tendrils that continue on the end of it, that's the tree's natural response to the pressures of wind and holding it in place.
So she can add some soil to the top of this, but not a lot.
That's true. So when you add soil to this area, you're limited to an inch and a half is tolerable. And that's not much. And if it's soil, you should be closer to the 1 inch, because soil has less penetration than, say, mulch, bark fines, or sphagnum moss, which allow for some penetration of water and air.
So what about mulch? Is that better?
I think mulch is better, because if you're a little bit thick, the mulch is going to break down. And as the mulch breaks down, there's kind of a tee that's created from rain and dew that the tree can take up. But the active growing for the tree and its roots are limited in this area. The more active stuff is out on the ends.
Further out, could you cover more or not?
You want to be really cautious. So this would be from the trunk and then a little bit beyond the drip line.
So if it splashed away once, why wouldn't it splash away again?
I think that's why you have to use the judgment of using maybe an organic covering other than soil to address this area. Yes.
The mulch wouldn't just splash away. Yeah, and stay in place.
Mulch kind of weaves together after you've put it down on the ground.
What can she do then once she spreads the mulch? Should she plant something there? Could she plant something there? Doesn't she want to plant something there?
Yes, that was part of Jody's goal. She likes hosta. She wants to put some bedding plants in that area, and there's a ton of things to choose from, you know, because you're kind of right back into the scenario of planting and selecting plants based on the light conditions, you know, the growing conditions, the cultural conditions that are there.
So the plants will help keep the soil in place. The mulch will help protect the plants and the roots. How does she go about planting these plants in this area that is so sort of overrun with roots?
I had a conversation with Jody about covering the ground, the bare soil areas, particularly in the photo, with the mulch, and then compacting it a little bit, either underfoot or with your garden hose. And then after it's dry, you can return to this area. And I recommended that she try to use a soil auger on the end of a drill, like you would drill for tulip bulbs. Mm-hmm. When you drill three or four holes close together, you've created the opening for one hole that's nice for, say, a quart to a gallon potted plant of some kind. When you're drilling this hole, you're going to find out if you can plant anything there, because if you run into root wood, you're not going to be able to. But what is produced from drilling the hole are some nice fines, soil fines, that are going to go back into the hole with some of the mulch that you've already put down. This hole that you've drilled into the ground to try and find a good planting space is also a really great way to help water and air to penetrate into this area where the tree's growth has compacted the soil over time.
But don't cut the roots to plant a hosta.
Absolutely not.
All right, so you've mentioned a few plants. Well, we talked about hostas. Specifically, what plants are you recommending Jody consider?
Well, Jody likes hosta, and I like hosta. You love ferns. I love ferns. You like the ostrich ferns and some of the painted ferns. They would be perfectly good on the shadier side of things.
The Japanese ferns.
I love all those. Yeah. Man, they're fabulous. I also discussed perennial ginger, either Canadian or European. One's fuzzy, one's glossy. And one of my favorite woodland perennials is sweet woodruff. It grows in a whirl with little white flowers.
So if this area turns out to be too woody because of the roots and the plants simply won't thrive or she can't plant them, what are some other options? Just a big mulch bed?
You could do that, but I think that for the gardener that would feel unfinished and kind of underwhelming. We talked about maybe incorporating some kind of stepping type stone that, or flagging pieces, which are even bigger. You can arrange those in a manner that looks like maybe there's a path sneaking between the tree and the house in this case. And then you could stop there, or you could put potted plants on those stones. So you can have your cake and eat it too, even if the roots are so aggressive. So if this was a Norway maple, for example, no luck, my friends. Those roots are like human hair in the soil, and they're so dense. Even if you drill a hole there, the plants will not survive.
The roots will choke them out.
That's right. And you can see Norway maples in various places here at the Fell Arboretum where the grass is not even growing and weeds aren't even growing under them.
So I go by some homes on my way to and from work, and every spring, the same homeowners are trying to plant grass every season where grass has failed year after year. Is there a shady mix that would work for Jody? And are people sort of just wasting their time trying to continue to plant grass where grass really doesn't want to grow?
Yeah, that's the thing. If no weeds are growing there, you're going to have a challenge just getting grass to grow there. Now, having said that, there are lots of grass and sod growers nationwide that make various blends of shade grass. They do not include Kentucky bluegrass, but they do include ryegrass and chewing fescue and other grasses that blend well with Kentucky bluegrass. The problem on those is a lot of times when the heat shows up, they just lay down and turn brown. And they don't pop back up until football season starts again. So if you're okay with that, there is a way to do it. And another issue I think that people get into with trying to grow grass in the shade is they cut the lawn too frequently, too short. So they get that first stand of grass, and man, I can't wait to get out there and mow it because that's going to make it look better. Well, not so much. You got to really let it grow for a while before you give it the first mow.
If you have any questions about gardening or tree roots like Jody, let us know, and we might answer them on an upcoming episode of Grow. I'm Mike McCurdy with Patrick Murphy. Send your gardening questions to wglt.org/grow.
Find this and all of GLT's podcasts where you get the rest of your podcasts. You can also subscribe at wglt.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, we'll get a listen to the GLT Summer Concert headliner, Adia Victoria, with John Norton. There is no more Kate Smith singing God Bless America at Yankee games. Her statue outside of the Philadelphia Flyers stadium is gone, too. The banishment comes from Smith being declared problematic for some songs with racist lyrics she recorded in the early 30s. While some call for context, others call for Smith to be canceled. Cancel culture is distinctly modern public shaming, and according to the GLT culture maven, there's a dark reason behind its apparent randomness. GLT arts correspondent Laura Kennedy has more.
Cancel culture goes beyond boycotting. That's according to Sherry Zeck, interim dean of Milner Library at Illinois State University, and GLT's culture maven. She says canceling often starts in social media, a place where anyone with a smartphone and a Twitter account can take aim at injustice and also get a taste of power.
Someone says or does something that of which you disapprove or that is not within your value system, and so you cancel them. You stop following them on Twitter, you tell your friends to stop following them on Twitter, and it possibly becomes a thing and is large enough to alter that person's fan base or sphere of influence, largely in social media. But it also can become big enough that it actually can, say, cancel a TV show like the Roseanne Barr situation.
What is the purpose, ultimately, of cancel culture? It seems that we have people on social media who have power that in years past people didn't have.
Well, I think people are genuinely trying to affect social change for the most part. Certainly, there are also plenty of people who just love to sound off and make themselves important. But I think that it comes from a genuine place where we want to have more control over what comes at us. And 30 years ago, when there were three TV stations and a lot of radio stations, we felt very out of power in terms of really affecting what was programmed in those areas. Now, a mass movement could have some effect, but it was very difficult to generate a mass movement at that time. Well, now with social media, anybody with a wiseacre line and a cute cat video could potentially reach thousands and thousands of people.
Recently, we had a call to cancel singer Kate Smith because some recordings that she had done in the early 1930s were highly objectionable. People today heard those songs and called to cancel Kate Smith. But also recently, there were calls to cancel Michael Jackson due to a documentary that came out
right.
and revealing some assault issues with minors. Now, the Kate Smith thing got traction. But Michael Jackson, that didn't seem to take hold. Why are some people canceled, but other people, the canceling just doesn't seem to take?
There are a lot of factors here, but just using your examples right there, how much money do you think Kate Smith stuff makes people right now versus how much money Michael Jackson stuff makes people? You know, I'm always going to say in the final instance it has to do with money, but it's not just about money. I'm sure there are folks out there who are defending Kate Smith and contextualizing her songs, and you know, she was just a singer, she didn't write it, was she under contract to sing these things, you know, blah, 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 blah. But all in all, half the population doesn't even know who she is. Michael Jackson still has some traction in popular culture. The charges against him are incredibly serious, but they're not new. There was a trial, and he was found innocent. So there's the story being told that comes from the documentary. There's the story that's being told by people who knew Jackson and believed him to be an honorable person. So those narratives are really competing with each other in this moment and in the context of his recordings still make a lot of money.
As you say, money has a lot to do with what does or does not get canceled. But why would somebody go to the lengths to dig up an old song by Kate Smith that was recorded, you know, 80 years ago, or an old interview with John Wayne that was in Playboy magazine? Don't we have enough to contend with today that we don't need to be bothered canceling people who are long dead?
First of all, historical research and historical accuracy has value in and of itself. So I think that there's a level of this that is about continuing the process of elucidating how entrenched and pervasive racism is in American culture. That's one way I would answer that. But the other way I would answer it is, I think in general, we find it much easier to get het up about and attack these relatively smaller matters than actually say, oh, I don't know, getting a racist out of the White House. I do think that we, by and large, many of us who are interested in social justice, get preoccupied and hung up on some of the smaller matters because the larger injustices are just so difficult to take down. So we take down what we can. Maybe that's the only way you take down the bigger injustices, is one small injustice at a time.
So when does a cultural artifact, movie, song, what have you, person, become so obsolete that it's an embarrassment to current generations?
At some level, it's never too old, as long as it's remembered. This radio station is within an educational institution. We are about resurrecting the past. We are about uncovering the past. We are about history and archaeology and all of those things. We're about not forgetting. And there's positive sides to that, and there are potential potholes to that. But in that regard, nothing is necessarily forgotten forever. I personally do think there are differences in terms of what is having a larger effect on the culture and therefore bears more scrutiny or perhaps cancellation. But it is sometimes the smaller things that people actually can control the existence and the outcome of, so that's what they go after.
It's power.
It's power. And one of the things that social media has afforded folks is sometimes an illusory sense of power, but sometimes real power. I mean, after all, it used to be that the people who were actually influencers in culture were celebrities on TV and in films, and politicians in a very different way. And so folks like you and me, maybe you because you're a radio personality, but but folks like you and me had really little hope of affecting other people. But now, you know, I do a pen review on YouTube and I get 100 followers. Other people who do them regularly get thousands of followers for pen reviews. So once again, if you have a smart tagline and a cute cat video, you can become an influencer. We're still, as a culture, trying to figure out how that kind of power actually works.
So why do we cancel and not forgive? Why do we choose canceling over forgiving?
Because we confuse forgiving with condoning. Once we started to realize as a culture that everything was connected, that text didn't exist out here, but that they exist in a web of responses and how those responses circulate, that made all of us part of what things mean. So if I say, well, I like Kevin Spacey anyway, I'm still going to see his movies, then at some level, I become as culpable for his actions being dismissed as someone who actually lied for him. Just in terms of how Kevin Spaceyness and Kevin Spacey's actions get read as a text or a series of texts in the world. So for someone to just say, Kevin Spacey, it's over between us, slam the door, they're refusing to be part of that thing that his actions and what we think about his actions and what we say about his actions means in the world. But I also think one of the real dangers in this is that we confuse two drops of bad in a cup with water that is going to poison us all and kill us, right? We have to be able to tell the difference between a stray remark that I might say, not knowing all of the cultural history of a particular metaphor I use or something, and my actually denying a job to someone because of their race or gender identity. Those are not the same thing. They might be connected, they might have a joined history, but they're not the same thing. And one of the things that I think is happening is we're getting very samey-samey about everything. So someone actually abusing a child is starting to exist on the same level of approbation as someone saying to a five-year-old girl, you're pretty. There are issues with treating five-year-old girls in terms of how they look and only talking to them about their hair, but that is not the same thing as raping a five-year-old girl. If we're going to change this culture, we have to be able to be self-reflective and critique all of the bad things we do while still maintaining perspective.
What about the future for cancel culture? I mean, do you see it continuing along this line? Do you see any looming trends?
I hate to say this, but it's going to wear out. Generations change in terms of how they use technology, and it's happening at a faster rate than we might imagine. So I think there will be new ways of communicating that will come in. And also, as a culture, we get exhausted by stuff really easy. We'll turn our attention to other things. Also, there will be resistance. There will be backlash. There will be resistance.
That's Sherry Zeck, Interim Dean of Milner Library at Illinois State University and GLT's culture maven. Another female artist from the early 20th century has been singled out by cancel culture. Last week, Bowling Green State University removed the name of actress Lillian Gish from its theater after students questioned acknowledging the actress, who starred in the 1915 D.W. Griffith film Birth of a Nation, a movie widely criticized for its racist themes. A new name for the theater remains undecided. I'm Laura Kennedy.
You can hear bonus audio from Sherry Zeck talking about how scholars can view cancel culture, plus why Prince got a pass from cancelers at our website, WGLT.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. GLT Summer Concert headliner Adia Victoria's blues lyrics have been compared favorably with author Flannery O'Connor, a fellow Southerner. A South Carolina native and now Nashville resident uses gothic characters and landscapes over blues seasoned with garage, punk, gospel, and rock. Victoria tells GLT's John Norton she's been a Flannery O'Connor fan for many years.
I mean, I think that I had a lot of the same ideas and inclinations that Flannery had growing up in the Deep South and growing up in a highly structured religious community. Once people start filling their heads with these wild ideas that they know the truth and they know the way to live and they understand what this is all about, then they're right for the writer and the artist to come in and subvert them. And any artist worth their salt, they're going to need to alienate themselves. They're going to require that alienation in order to turn that knife towards these systems of oppression. And, you know, it's not heavy work. It's often done very humorously by Flannery. And I think that she was able to gather and refine and distill a lot of my hunches that I had as a kid growing up into something more artistic. She was able to articulate it in a way that I was not able to. These are just ideas that I had, you know, about my Bible school teacher and my preachers and all of the adults around me that I recognized were so very, very, very afraid.
What do you mean? What are they afraid of?
The loss of control, the unbridled truth that nobody knows what's going on. Nobody knows why we're here. Nobody knows what happens after we die. There's no concrete evidence. And I think that this truth can drive man wild. I think it drives people insane. If you need that control, if you need that ability to say concretely, like, this is what it is, this is God, this is what God's what, this is God's will, it's like, you have no idea what God's will is. I guarantee you that it's not capitalism. I guarantee you it's not whatever we fashioned as the American dream. But there is a fear of losing that power over people that have bought into that.
Adia Victoria from the album Silence. It's called Pacolet Road. And Adia, this song talks about you wanting to get the heck out of South Carolina where you grew up. But it also references your grandmother in that line where it says you want to do everything your grandma wished she could have done.
I'm going up them stairs. I'm going to pack a bag. I'm going to do everything in the world that my grandma ever wished she had.
Is this a reference to your actual grandmother, or is this more symbolic?
My grandmother was it is a literal reference, but it's also symbolic of these black women who had brilliance. My grandmother was one of the hidden figures. She worked for GE during the space mission in the 50s and 60s when they were trying to put a man on the moon, and she was a brilliant secretary to several engineers whose work, you know, would go into getting these men on the moon. But my grandmother is someone who, she married young, she had children, and that became the center of her life. And my grandma is also a brilliant artist. Growing up, she instilled in me the importance of education, of learning, and not necessarily like getting good grades in school, but having that curiosity to learn about the world around you. She taught me how to read. You know, my grandma used to let me drive her car around the country in South Carolina when I was like 7. She'd, pull over. We'd be coming home from Ingalls, and she'd let me get in the driver's seat, and she'd say, "Now you drive us home."
7 years old?
7 years old. She was trying to tell me, it's like, you need to know where you're going. You need to know how to get around in this world. And she didn't come up in a time where it was easy for women, let alone black women, to have that sense of autonomy. And so her journey, and she'll tell you the same, was stifled. And it wasn't until my grandfather died about 3 years ago that my grandmother, out of nowhere, she began to paint voraciously. Like, she's done over like 200 portraits. She's had this in her the whole time. And it's like, God, like, what could she have been if the world had nurtured her brilliance, if they had recognized this woman is a genius? So I see it as imperative in me to go and further her line and do all the things that she wished that she had.
I want to play another song. It's called The Devil Is a Lie. It's from the album Silences.
I keep my head held high, my eyes on the sky. The devil keeps telling me lies. And it don't matter what I do, I know my demons coming too. The devil keeps telling me lies.
But really, what is testing me is the man who's sitting next to me, the stress of always having to be happy all the time. Is this a nod to how women are supposed to comport themselves, or where does this come from?
Yeah, it's the emotional labor that women are tasked with, to constantly have to be an acquiescing presence for men to constantly manage the male ego, to satiate it, to placate it, to keep it calm. It's terrifying work. Men are terrifying, you know, because men have been so locked out of their emotions, because especially in this country, men vacillate between fear and rage. And that's the way that our system speaks. And those are the places in men that our system pokes most often, is fear and rage. So if you're constantly made to be afraid and then in a state of agitation, you're going to punch down whoever's below you. And that happens to be women. You know, we're just not as powerful as men. So they're able to, you know, step up and be tall by standing on us. And women have had to do this kind of jujitsu work of not agitating men just to stay alive. And it's exhausting. It's stressful. It's, oh God, like, what am I going to have to deal with this man? And you see it all the time. Like yesterday, I was in a gas station in West Virginia, and there's this guy, this old fat dude in front of me. And he was checking out, and the woman, the cash register, she was this young woman, and he was like aggressively hitting on her and jokingly, like with this laugh, but it was to the point where it was like so inappropriate and just got worse and worse. And the first thing that I felt was, while he was joking, was I felt this instinct to laugh at his jokes that weren't funny. They were terrifying. And the girl was laughing too, like, oh, okay, okay. But like really what you wanted to say was, hey, fat ass, like get your ass out of here. Like, what the fuck is wrong with you? But you can't do that because, you know, he could turn around and have a gun and destroy you. So that's what that line is speaking to. It's just this emotional labor that women have put on our shoulders to keep the men happy.
Say you're looking for something to make you feel new. You don't believe in God, ha! Whiskey will do. You say you're looking for something that you feel anew. You don't believe in God, well, whiskey will do. Yes, whiskey will do.
Idea Victoria is our GLT summer concert headliner. This is Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton. You're a blues artist, and you're someone that got to the blues maybe a little over a decade ago in your early 20s. What was it about this music that got your attention?
So the blues, there's call and response. And the call is the singer announcing something, you know, a state of fact. And then it gives the response is the audience's chance to participate to confirm that. The blues is about building community. It's about recognition. It's about being seen and giving voice to the unheard. It's a collective exercise. And for me, growing up in the church and in the South, there was no chance for response. You had people telling you, like, this is what will send you to heaven, this is what will send you to hell, this is good, this is bad, this is black, this is white. And you have no, there's no chance for recourse from you. So for me, finding the blues, it was the first time I felt that somebody was talking to me. Somebody held space for me at the end of their lyric to say, ain't that right? Don't you agree? Am I wrong? You feel me? That's what the blues did to me. It gave me a chance to respond, to sing along with somebody, to have artists be like, I know what you're going through. You're not alone. You know, you look at artists like Ma Rainey and Bessie Smith, like the true superstars of the blues, the original founders of the blues. And these were women who would go out and sing their songs about sexual liberation and women traveling and women being able to decide things in their lives for the first time ever. Like, these women were one generation removed from slavery. So they were the first people that looked like them that had any autonomy in their life whatsoever. And what did they do? What was the first thing that those women did? They started singing about the way that their lives looked. They started singing about the ways that they were going through the world. And then they would sing directly to other women. You know, they would say, girls, you know, you feel me? You hear me? They would, this is the way that they would communicate. So the blues allowed me to feel a part of something. It allowed me to locate myself on a plane of existence, which is something that I hadn't experienced before because I grew up in such a white world. I was so isolated. And the blues allowed me to be somebody's sister, somebody's daughter, somebody's niece that had walked before me, and now she was passing on the benefit of her life experiences, of her wisdom to me. That's what the blues is.
GLT Summer Concert headliner and Atlantic recording artist Adia Victoria speaking with GLT's John Norton. The June 8th show, sponsored by CEFQ, includes the Grammy Award-winning Rebirth Brass Band, legendary Bloomington band, the Something Brothers, and the emerging Third Street Down. Discover other local music and hear from artists playing in Central Illinois on the GLT Music Podcast. Find it on NPR One or your favorite podcast app. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. WGLT.org is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Eric Stock, Mike McCurdy, John Norton, and Laura Kennedy. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. This is 89.1 and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.